out session. Judge Connolly, Judge Werke, Judge Bradfield, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if they choose to exercise it. So our first case this morning is the State of Minnesota versus, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Jesse Lee Bonacci-Koski. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Russett. I represent Mr. Bonacci-Koski, the appellant in this case. Mr. Bonacci-Koski is appealing his conviction from St. Louis County for second-degree manslaughter. We've raised a number of issues on appeal. What I would hope to do this morning is to focus primarily on two of those issues that I think are dispositive of this case. The first is whether or not the state met its burden of proving that appellant caused the death of BK by committing or attempting to commit a violation of the child neglect or child endangerment statute. And the second is whether or not the district court committed reversible error by seating a biased juror in this case. Certainly welcome any questions the court has on any of the issues during the course of my argument in addition to these. I'd like to start with the causation issue. As is abundantly apparent from our briefs, the parties disagree as to what exactly it is the state must prove in order to establish the causation element in this case. The statute, by its plain language, requires that the defendant commit an act of child neglect or endangerment, and in our opinion, requires that that act be the but-for cause of the child's death. The state takes a different position and argues that it is sufficient if the act or the conduct constituting child neglect or endangerment was a substantial factor in causing the child's death. What I want to suggest to you this morning is it makes no difference. Even if you adopt the state's position and require nothing more than a showing that the act constituting neglect or endangerment need only constitute a substantial factor, the state has failed to meet its burden in this case to prove that it was, in this case, a substantial factor in causing BK's death. The evidence, in fact, shows that it was not a factor at all, much less a substantial factor.
Mr. Russett, what wasn't a factor?
The conduct that constitutes the child neglect or endangerment violation. So the statute requires that the
So you don't think, assuming in the light most favorable to the verdict, that going out when you're supposed to be babysitting a 11-month-old to, you know, arguably use meth is not a substantial factor in?
Not in causing the death in this case, Your Honor, and that's really the question before the court. It's reprehensible. Let's not dispute that, but the question is causation.
Right. Well, I certainly agree with you there, and there may be some questions on the intervening superseding cause, but, you know, in looking at one of the unpublished cases that I think was referenced in Mr. Stockmeyer's brief, State v. Pearson, you know, the language they seem to focus on is the act must be one which the party ought, in the exercise of ordinary care, to have anticipated was likely to result in injury to others, though we could not have anticipated the particular injury which did happen. There must be a showing that the defendant's conduct was a substantial factor in bringing about the injury. So if he is supposed to be the child care provider and for an 11-month-old, and he leaves the house for a couple of hours to take meth, while he certainly couldn't have anticipated there was going to be a fire, I'm not sure he had to, as long as he would have realized that if you're supposed to be taking care of someone, you shouldn't go out, well, an infant, and shoot up meth, because bad things could happen, and it might not be a fire, but, you know, maybe the kid would stick its head, you know, between the, I know, I was going to say bars, that's probably not the right word.
Crib rails.
Thank you, Judge Bradfield. The crib rails, or you know, or all the horrible things we always envision are going to happen to small children. So I guess under that standard, why don't you lose?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, that decision is unpublished, so it really has no presidential value here.
It is relying on Lubbers v. Anderson, which is a published Supreme Court decision indicating the tests for, you know, proximate cause of injuries.
Sure it is, and I think the key part of what you reviewed there is it still has to be a substantial factor in causing a death. Your question assumes...
He was there, and I certainly agree with you, there was no testimony that, you know, if he had told the fireman the kid was there, they would have saved him. But,
that's the key. There is no evidence.
If he was there in the house when the fire started, rather than going out shooting meth, well, presumably he would have taken the kid out of the house or done something.
And I guess that's where the state and I disagree. The presumption. We don't engage in presumptions. We need evidence. There is no evidence in this case that would support a juror finding that this
reasonable babysitter would have done, who's not on meth, sitting in the house when a fire starts.
A reasonable babysitter not on meth, sitting in the house, would probably have been asleep in the downstairs bedroom where he always slept, according to the evidence in the record.
At 5:30 in the morning?
Well, that's where I would be at 5:30 in the morning, sleeping in my bedroom. So again, we're making assumptions. We're speculating about what might have happened had he been home. And my primary point here is that we don't convict people based upon speculation. It is just as easily for me to stand here and speculate that he would have been asleep in his bed at the time of the fire and that he too would have perished in that fire had he been home.
Well, what if he
the burden is on this?
What if he had shot up meth in the home and stayed there? And the exact same circumstances happened. Is that different?
I think the state has to prove, Your Honor, that had he been home, that there is some evidence that would suggest and indicate that he would have saved that child's life. They could do that with expert testimony, for example, about how quickly this fire spread. They could do it with testimony, and we actually have testimony in this case, about how quickly an adult in that house would have been overcome by the smoke themselves. There's testimony in this case that could have happened within minutes. They could have introduced evidence about whether or not there was a fire alarm in this case that would have notified somebody who's sleeping downstairs that there was a fire. A smoke alarm would have awakened that person if they were sleeping. That they could have produced evidence that there were fire extinguishers. What they can't do, and what the Constitution doesn't allow them to do, is simply speculate that this child, had he been home and had he been present, he would have saved that child. And we need evidence. We need evidence that would support that inference, that would make it a reasonable inference.
Well, Judge Pagliacetti seemed to place great weight on sort of, well, the negligence was continuing, and that's why I didn't give your client's lawyers an intervening instruction, because supposedly when he comes back, he sees the fire, and runs away. What about that continuing?
Well, the continuing conduct, I mean, the question of whether the instruction should have been given is a separate issue. But with regard to the sufficiency argument, it's not clear to me, and I don't know that the state has ever identified specifically what act it is that the client did that constitutes the act of neglect or endangerment. Was it leaving the house in the first place? Was it not notifying the firefighters?
I think they would argue, or at least as I interpreted Judge Pagliacetti's decision, it was both. But for me, it's certainly leaving the house to shoot up meth. That seems a problem.
And let's assume that conduct, for purposes of argument here, constitutes child neglect or child endangerment. Now, we argue that it doesn't for the reasons in our brief, but let's assume for purposes of argument it does. That's half the equation. We now have to show that act of leaving and that act of not notifying the firefighters under the state's theory, was at least a substantial factor in causing the child's death. And that's where the argument, I think, the state's position falls apart. Because their whole theory is premised on this idea that if he had not left, and that if he had notified the firefighters, the child would not have died. And again, I think if there were evidence that supported that theory and that supported that argument, it might have merit. There is no evidence. It is pure speculation.
You state that, though. Your phrasing is in the but-for formula, that if the defendant had remained present or had immediately notified the firefighters of the child's presence upstairs, then, you know, the child would have been saved. Where I think our law says that it's the state's obligation to show that that defendant's neglect is a substantial factor.
Well,
so again, I know you contest the neglect. I understand that. But as you just said, if we assume the neglect and then just test it to say, well, is there evidence in the record when viewed favorably to the jury's verdict to show that that neglect was a substantial factor in causing this child's death? It seems the evidence is there.
Well, and I guess I don't. I just respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I don't know that the state has identified any evidence.
Yeah, they don't have to show with certainty that this that the defendant, not on meth, would have, you know, detected the fire before this person outside the house. I mean, there's certainly a reasonable inference. The person who did detect the fire was actually outside the house, right? So someone presumably inside the house would have detected the fire sooner. The firefighters did testify that had they been told that there was a child upstairs, they would have immediately gone upstairs. That would have been their first approach, not staying in the kitchen and trying to suppress the fire. So there is evidence from which I think a jury can infer that an adult who is actually supervising the child would have made a difference.
Well, and again, I respectfully disagree, and we have to remember the firefighters also testified that yes, they would have gone upstairs sooner, but they could not testify and would not testify that it would have made any difference in the outcome of this case. We don't even know, and the evidence does not establish that that child was even alive at the time that the firefighters arrived. We do know that when it was first discovered, the house by the neighbor, after returning from his run, the house was already engulfed in smoke. And he himself tried to get in the house and couldn't because of the smoke. We know that when the actual firefighters themselves arrived, it was engulfed in smoke.
Does it make any difference or not whether he left to shoot up meth? He denied that later, but does it make any difference? He left.
I don't know that it does, Your Honor. The conduct here is that he left this child alone, and I think that's the...
Whether he could reasonably care for the child, right? I mean, isn't that what it comes down to? Whether the evidence showed that he could reasonably care for this child.
For purposes of determining whether or not he committed an act of child endangerment?
Yes. Not endangerment, the neglect.
The neglect. The neglect required the state to prove that he deprived the child of the required supervision appropriate to that child's age and circumstances.
You would agree that by leaving the house, for whatever reason, leaving this youngster in this baby in a crib would constitute that neglect.
No, I don't agree, Your Honor, because I don't think leaving a 11-month-old child alone for a couple of hours while they're sleeping is depriving that child of the required supervision that child needs. Parents do this all the time.
What case says what you just said?
Well, I don't know that there's a case, Your Honor. I think it's just reality.
I don't want
to. If not, every parent is guilty of neglect when they leave their child sleeping alone in a bedroom for 2 hours. That clearly isn't the case. If you leave the child in a bedroom in a situation that could pose danger to the child.
Your kid in a car.
Well, yes, in sub-freezing temperatures.
No, period. If you leave your kid in a car for any period of time, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that's child neglect.
We have a case that says just the opposite, Your Honor. It's cited in my brief and relied on in our brief where they left two children in a car in sub-zero temperatures for an extended period of time. And this court reversed the conviction, saying, no, that doesn't constitute, that itself does not constitute any child neglect or child endangerment.
Well, endangerment, but we're talking neglect. It would constitute neglect. I mean, the statute is pretty clear in terms of age-appropriate children being left unsupervised.
It also requires that the defendant willfully deprive the child of supervision appropriate to that child's age that harms or is likely to substantially harm the child.
So those elements are here in this case for the neglect. I'm not talking about the endangerment.
Well, again, I disagree because I don't think leaving a child, an 11-month-old who is sleeping in the crib alone for 2 hours, deprives that child of supervision appropriate to their age. Now, Again, if we assume, for purposes of argument, that it does, the question for the manslaughter charge becomes, well, now we have to prove that that's what caused the child's death. Is the fact that he left the child alone for 2 hours the cause of the death in this case? It's not. It's the fact that there was a fire that arose from a completely unrelated source for which the defendant, everybody agrees, is not responsible for, that caused the child's death. It wasn't, and again, the state will say it was, well, that his failure to be there and save the child contributed to that. And I guess that is where the sufficiency argument turns on. Is there evidence proving beyond a reasonable doubt that that is true? Because that's their burden of proof. We can't assume. We can't speculate. There has to be evidence to support that proposition, and that is where we argue that the state's evidence is lacking.
Well, I agree with you, Judge Willis, in the Tice case. That supports your position. I will say I note it was 40 minutes, and the issue is likely, more likely than not, to cause substantial harm to the child. And I guess I think this case is different because if you are going out to shoot up meth, you know, you might not be gone. You might be gone forever.
Just real quickly, assuming that's true, again, the issue then becomes causation, and that's really the where our argument focuses on here, is that for manslaughter, they didn't prove the causation.
Thank you, Mr. Ressert. You will have rebuttal. Mr. Stockmeyer?
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning on behalf of Respondent, the State of Minnesota. I'd like to begin by addressing a point that Mr. Russert made towards the end of the argument, and that is that if the state were to prevail in this case, every parent would be guilty of child neglect if they left their child alone in a bedroom for a couple hours. And that's just simply not true on the face of the child neglect statute. And I think the important element, which isn't really a disputed element in this case, but that in order to commit child neglect, the state has to prove that the defendant willfully deprived the child of age-appropriate supervision. So if a parent thinks their child is taking a nap and goes out into the yard, which is the hypothetical posited in the brief, I don't think that parent has not committed child neglect if something happens to that child, because they're not willfully depriving the child of age-appropriate supervision. In this case, the defendant checked on the child before he left. That comes from his own statement. He then left the house with the dog, but not the child, went to smoke methamphetamine, and a fire occurred. That defendant has willfully deprived this child of age-appropriate supervision. This statute does not make someone criminally culpable just because they're a tired parent and they make a mistake. It makes somebody criminally culpable for willfully depriving a young child of age-appropriate supervision.
So I'm just curious, do you think the fact that he was apparently going to smoke meth makes a difference or not? What if he was going to buy a pack of smokes?
I
mean, we talk about that criminal element, he's going to go and meth up, but is that even relevant?
I think it's relevant because it's, of course, a really important factor in this case. But if we were to talk
show
about
the intent and the recklessness as far as the endangerment, but wouldn't that also be true if he left this child and didn't come back for a couple of hours because he was looking for a cigarette machine or wanted to go see a girlfriend? I mean,
I think that's true, Your Honor. I mean, if you abandon a child, an 11-month-old child, in a house for an extended period of time, you don't bring the child with you. You have willfully deprived that child of age-appropriate supervision. Children of this age are completely dependent on their caregivers.
Mr. Stockmeyer, I'd like to follow up on a hypothetical that Mr. Russert sort of suggested. So let's assume this. Mom it's, you know, mom and husband, husband's at work. Mom decides at, you know, 4 a.m. to go out for a 20-minute run. She trips, knocks her head, you know, knocks her head, unconscious, 2 hours, house burns down, kid's dead. On those facts, would she be have entitled to an intervening or superseding instruction?
Just to clarify, Your Honor, what was the immediate cause of the child's death? Was it a fire?
Okay. Everything's identical. The difference is she goes out for what she assumes, and you know what? Let's make it even perfect. A 40-minute run. No meth, no drugs. She's mom of the year. And she falls down, trips over a rock, unconscious for 3 hours, house burns down, kid dead. And state charges her with, you know, all the things he's been charged with. Would she have been entitled to an intervening or superseding instruction as was requested in this case by the defendant's lawyer?
I think not, Your Honor. And the reason is...
Well, you're tough, I tell you.
I mean, to be honest, Your Honor...
I'm not saying she gets acquitted or gets a motion to dismiss. All I'm saying is she gets an instruction based on the evidence and the jury gets to hear whatever, you know, Mr. Russert, had he been trial counsel, would have argued.
Right, and I don't think she does get the instruction.
Why not?
And let me explain why. I think really this goes to the state's basic conception of the causal issues at stake here, and that this is a case involving coinciding causes, coinciding or concurrent causes. You have two causal factors, neither of which were in themselves sufficient to bring about the harm to the child, but both were necessary conditions of the harm. And the precedent from the Minnesota Supreme Court is very clear that the superseding intervening cause instruction is only appropriate if the alleged superseding cause is the sole cause of the child's death. And I would specifically refer this court to the Gatson case, State versus Gatson, which is cited in the brief. There, the district court denied a superseding cause instruction, and the Minnesota Supreme Court held that that was appropriate because the alleged superseding cause as a matter of law was not the sole cause. The defendant's conduct had also played a part in bringing about the child's death, and so that instruction could not be.
Well, what about the fact that the knockout, the unconsciousness, is evidence that there would have been a superseding intervening cause, and compare that to the facts we have in this case? What evidence was there that there was any superseding intervening cause? There isn't any evidence that this guy fell down and was unconscious. There isn't any evidence that somebody prohibited him from coming back. I mean, isn't that what we're talking about? Where is the evidence to support the court giving that instruction to the jury?
Correct, Your Honor, and I would agree.
I guess I'm arguing your case.
Exactly. I was starting to wonder if I was understanding your question.
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm just thinking out loud because I was fascinated by that scenario, but then I started thinking, where's the evidence that was submitted in the case at hand that would support giving the jury such an instruction?
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think what you need is you need a causal factor where I think the test would be you need a causal factor where a reasonable jury could conclude that this is wholly separate and apart from the defendant's conduct. It is not part of a single chain of events. It is a wholly separate chain of events. Here, because the predicate crime is the failure to provide age-appropriate supervision, the defendant's absence is integral to the chain of events that led to this child's death. Even if the defendant had been home when the fire started, the defendant would have been under a legal obligation to protect the child. He needs to supervise the child. And so you cannot disentangle his failure to be there for this child from the fact of the child's death. No reasonable jury could come to that conclusion.
You know, Mr. Stockmeyer, all the cases that you've cited, and I think you've cited every single one of them, they all seem to be slightly different. You know, the daycare cases, or I should say Sirette, okay, so it was a cerebral palsy, 24-hour notice, requiring 24-hour supervision. You know, the daycare cases, they all seem to know that the kids had once before gotten out of the car seat, and therefore they were kind of on notice. You know, they all seem to be sort of, I don't know, for want of a better word, you know, negligence plus. So I guess my question and the issue that I wrestle with, speaking for myself and not the panel, is, you know, why wasn't he entitled, since there was evidence to support it, or some evidence, for an intervening instruction? And then everyone could argue the exact same things they argued now, but it seems to me, you know, we normally don't expect fires to break out, and there is the evidence, as Mr. Russert pointed out, that, well, you know, there's no evidence the kid would have lived if the fireman had gotten to there sooner or if he had been in the house sober. So why wasn't he entitled to an intervening superseding instruction so he could at least make the argument he wanted to make that it was the fire, you know? And I mean, you know, in all candor, speaking for myself again, you know, as soon as the jury heard he was out smoking meth, I think he was toast. So at the very least, shouldn't he have been allowed to argue, hey, you know, the fire, you know, I'm a meth head, but, you know, I didn't set the fire, and there's no evidence that he did, and we don't know why the fire. So what? Why shouldn't he have at least gotten that instruction?
Your Honor, I guess to address the aspects of your question in reverse. I don't think it would be appropriate to give the instruction just because we're pretty sure the jury would have found him guilty anyway under the circumstances. And I don't mean to be flip.
No, I get that. But I mean, he's entitled to get an instruction if the law supports it. So you're just saying the law does not support it, period.
The law does not support it, and it's because you cannot disentangle not just his absence. Let's abstract it away from his absence. The predicate offense is willful or intentional failure to provide age-appropriate supervision. So would this child have died in this fire had he not His failure to provide age-appropriate supervision, no matter what form that takes, if a fire occurs, you cannot disentangle his conduct in not properly supervising the child from the fact of the child's death. These are not two different causal chains. They are bound up together.
If he was home, he was capable of carrying out his duty.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And he would be under a duty to do so. And I would like to point out on the facts, I know there's been some...
Talk about the facts, because the record's a little sparse on whether he could have reasonably even cared for the child. So now we're talking about his propensity to use chemicals.
Well, I don't think that would defeat an argument that he was capable of caring for the child. The meth use in the home...
We just said that if he was home, it's presumed he would have been capable of carrying out his duty. So how do we know he was even capable of carrying out that duty?
Well, if he's smoking meth, that would be a different form of failure to provide age-appropriate supervision. So that doesn't get us anywhere, because he's still then engaging in child neglect.
Well, here's what I'm getting at. If this child was left in the care of a six-year-old, and the six-year-old wanders off, I mean, obviously the six-year-old is not capable of providing care, so that theory then falls apart. Or if it's someone that is mentally unstable or somebody that otherwise is not physically able to care.
I agree 100% with that, Your Honor. That is not this defendant, and there is no evidence in the record to
suggest. What's the evidence that he was suitable to take care of this child?
Well, the child's parents left the child with him. He is the child's uncle. He is an adult. Other than the fact that he's a meth user, which is negligence if you're doing while you're carrying a child, there is no reason to believe that he was not. And The defense never disputed that at trial, and it's not disputed here on appeal. But I would like to point out the facts in the record about what the defendant could have done, because the evidence is that this fire started in the kitchen and that the child did not die from combustion. The child did not die in flames. The child died from exposure to the smoke, from inhalation of the smoke.
You're asking what I'm curious about, counsel. What was your evidence to show that the timeline would have at least allowed the jury to infer that had the defendant been present, that it would have made a difference? And you can talk either about detection of the fire, rescuing the child, or notifying the fire department.
So, as
I understand it, there's very little evidence on timeline. We don't know when the fire started. We do know when it was detected outside the house. And we know that it was in a sufficiently bad state when the firefighters arrived that they had to really struggle to get into the interior of the house.
Correct, Your Honor. So just in terms of the timeline, just to identify everything. 6:40 a.m., the neighbor comes home. There's no testimony that he saw any smoke. Neighbor comes home again after working out. There's smoke billowing out of the window, but no flames. The firefighters arrive 7 minutes later at 7:47.
Neighbor went and banged on the door. Didn't the neighbor go and try to arouse to see if anybody's in the house?
The second time.
Yeah, right.
Correct, Your Honor.
Before the fire people came.
Right, but that was only seven. That's only a time span of 7 minutes. And
that's a long time.
It is a long time, Your Honor, but we also know that the defendant's statements indicated that he saw the fire engines approaching. He saw the lights, he heard the sirens, and he went to check out what was going on, and that's at the point in time when he fled. So that's a pretty tight timeline.
In terms of knowing when this fire started.
Correct, Your Honor. We do not know when the fire started, but I would say...
We don't even have a time of death for the child, isn't that right?
We do not have a time of death.
We don't know when the child was found.
Right, but what we do have, and if I'm about to run out of time, if I could just finish
this
point. What we do have is that the child died from exposure to smoke. And from that, the jury can infer that the child was not in a situation where he was suddenly unable to be escaped, that nobody could have gotten him. He could have been saved because, in essence, he died from being exposed for a period of time. Had the defendant...
The record that indicates that.
The fact that he died from exposure...
That had an adult been present, the child could have been rescued from the smoke.
The inference that the jury can draw from the fact that this was a death from exposure, it was not a sudden death, it took a period of time. That's the nature of exposure to smoke.
Well,
and had the...
So, counsel, that's the nature of exposure to folks to smoke. I mean, if we all read the newspapers many, many times, individuals die in a home fire while they are sleeping upstairs. And I think that the argument that you're getting from appellant's counsel is that what if our defendant had been upstairs sleeping in that other bedroom?
If the
also have simply died. That's the end of the story.
I'll throw one other fact out there. All of this occurred, we know, after 6:40 a.m. It's an 11-month-old child. I think there is a fairly strong inference there that the child was not asleep when all of this occurred.
Based on what?
The fact that he's an 11-month-old child. Oh, and
my first son was the best sleeper in the world. So not...
Perhaps.
The others weren't, but I've... So I had one last question, Ms. Tuckmore. So fire in the kitchen, child was upstairs?
Child was upstairs.
Is that a two-story house?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Tuckmore. Thank you.
We simply ask that this court affirm the conviction. Thank you.
I think I could have inferred that from the evidence. All right, Mr. Russert, you have the last word, sir.
A couple of points. Let's talk about the instruction briefly. The state's given you their theory as to why this cannot be a superseding intervening cause. I agree, Your Honor, with your question. That's an issue for the jury. That's a fact question. Certainly, they could have argued to the jury that these two things worked together to cause the death. The defense should have been allowed to argue to the jury that the cause of the death was the fire and that had nothing to do with the conduct constituting the child neglect and endangerment, that there was a disconnect, that the normal course of events from the defendant having left that house would not have caused this child's death. The cause of the death was the fire, which was not foreseeable, and which came after the act. That's the fact question.
Negligence, we're talking about what his duty was. And if he had been in the house, he would have been capable of carrying out that duty. I mean, we talk about the death, but what about, I mean,
but Your Honor,
there, this comes in, the underlying theory is that he was negligent, which I think is very strong, and or the other one requires that there be the maliciousness or the
I think we're conflating two different issues, Your Honor, and perhaps I'm just not understanding your question. But the first thing the state has to prove is that the defendant violated the child neglect and child endangerment statutes.
Right. Right.
They then also have to prove that by doing so, that act caused the death. This is the next issue.
Substantial factor in bringing about the injury.
Well, that's their position. Our position is that language requires a but-for cause.
But that's the whole thrust of the argument, right?
Well, no, because I think again, going back to where I started, even if we do a substantial factor, they still have to prove it's a substantial factor. The Supreme Court has said that when you're applying substantial factor, the defendant is entitled to a supervening interceding cause instruction, assuming there's evidence to support it. The state has given you their view of the evidence and said it doesn't support it. We can make an argument, and we have, to just the opposite. It does support it. That's what we have juries for, to decide. The district court's conclusion for not submitting it was based upon this idea that this was a continuing offense. Again, that's a fact question. The jury may have concluded otherwise. And I also think that the state's position really is misinterpreting that language. The case that I cited, the civil case about the truck that parked in a position that caused an accident, if the negligence or the conduct is not ongoing, then the causal element is broken, and there's no need to have a superseding intervening cause. Because let's assume the defendant came home. Let's assume he left the house. He didn't use meth. He left the child alone. Let's assume that's child neglect. He comes back. The house blows up from a gas explosion. There's no causal connection between the act in the explosion. His conduct did not cause the death. It was not a substantial factor in causing the death. The sole cause of death was the gas explosion, which cannot be attributed to the defendant's act of neglect in any way, shape, or form. Let's assume the same facts. The defendant leaves and he doesn't come back, and the house blows up from a gas explosion. The question then becomes, well, is this attributable to the defendant? That's a jury question. Or is the gas explosion itself, because it wasn't caused by the defendant, the superseding cause?
On that exact hypothesis, Mr. Russert, so, he's on meth, and, he steals a car and doesn't come back, okay? Because a lot of people on meth do crazy things, and, so let's say he didn't even see the fire, he didn't come back at all. He's on meth. He gets in the car, he steals the car, he goes and he just drives away. And then, whatever bad things happened at the house. Why wouldn't he be liable then? I mean, if you are on meth, when you're supposed to be taking care of an 11-month-old, you're on meth, you steal a car, and you just drive away, it seems to me you own it.
I think that would be true if the statute in this case was worded differently and said that whenever a child dies while the defendant is committing an act of child neglect, the defendant is guilty. That's not what this statute says. It requires that the death be caused by the act of child neglect. There requires a causal connection.
In the exercise of ordinary care, if you're supposed to take care of an 11-month-old, you shoot up on meth, steal a car, and never come back, isn't it anticipated there was likely to result in an injury to that child, although you could not have anticipated the particular injury which did happen? I mean, it seems to me
there's a difference between foreseeability of the actual cause of death and the cause. So I think I would just caution the court not to confuse the question of foreseeability with the issue of causation. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Russert. Thank you very much, Mr. Stockmar. It was nice to see you again, Mr. Stockmar. The matter is submitted. Our next case is the State of Minnesota versus Joseph Rezac.